Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
An elected office where the money's big enough to really matter. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. California's state treasurer manages the state's $70 billion investment fund and markets billions more in bonds for the state and local governments. The incumbent is Bill Lockyer, a Democrat who's been in elected office for 37 straight years. Challenging his re-election is Mimi Walters, a former investment banker, termed out after 12 years in the state Senate. We'll hear them debate tonight. What does the environment have to do with it? Also tonight, the Rose Parade and Southern cooking. Later on, the Tea Partiers and the Congress. First, here's the news. We're only back with Which Way LA on KCRW. Tea Partiers don't like either political party, but their candidates are Republicans as a matter of public reality. Not many are expected to make it to Capitol Hill, but later on we'll ask, could they have influence beyond their numbers? First, the race for state treasurer, a little-known officer who deals with a lot of money. He or she oversees a $70 billion investment account, issues and markets billions in bonds for public works projects, and sits on a lot of governing boards and commissions. The incumbent is Democrat Bill Lockyer, who's been in the Assembly, led the state Senate, and was Attorney General for 8 years. He's running for re-election. We'll begin with his Republican challenger, State Senator Mimi Walters, who was an investment banker before serving the maximum 3 terms in the upper house in Sacramento. Senator Walters, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Why should the voters replace Mr. Lockyer with you?
Well, first of all, I'm a mom of 4 children, and I was born and raised in the state of California, and we are facing the worst fiscal crisis since the Great Depression. And I'm tired of career politicians jumping from office to office who have no experience. My background is in the investment experience, and because our current treasurer doesn't have experience, when he was in office, he lost the taxpayers $123 million on a single bond offering because he did a negotiated deal instead of a competitive deal. And we can't fool around anymore. We have to have somebody in that office who understands what it's like to invest and who's going to protect the taxpayer and make sure that the taxpayer dollars is protected.
You say he's jumping from office to office, aren't you? You're going from the state Senate. You want to be the treasurer.
Well, I've always been an investment person, and I have only been in office for 6 years. And he has been in office for 37 years in Sacramento.
Mimi Walters, state senator, Republican from Orange County. Bill Lockyer, incumbent state treasurer. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you.
How do you respond to what we just heard?
Well, it seems to me Sacramento needs some growing ups. So I take pride in having had considerable experience in both the legislative and executive branches that is useful, perhaps vital, in a time when California needs strong, experienced leaders. So I don't deny having been an office holder. I take pride in that. That's what I've done for my career in addition to being an attorney and a school teacher and other things. But what I will argue about is the claim that somehow we lost a lot of money in one bond deal. Now, maybe someone who came out of the Mike Milken bond factory as her prior employment in Wall Street would make that claim. Not something I'd brag about, but it's just factually not true. And every expert that's looked at it, except one journalist for one newspaper that wanted to try to write that kind of story, and then it gets repeated by those like my opponent who rely on Tea Party slogans for their candidacy, it's just not true. So we do competitive deals. We do negotiated deals. It varies with the timing in the market. I rely on a lot of experts, as well as what I've learned, to do this smartly and well. Every newspaper editorial in the state has commented on Lockyer being the right person to be treasurer during this bad time and that he ought to continue. I'm pleased editorialists have that view.
Well, what about that one bond issue? Did you or did you not lose money?
No. Here's the theory. The theory is you sell bonds with negotiated deals. Now, with negotiated deals, first of all, we're talking about at the heart, the middle of the meltdown in the national financial system during the last year of Bush. And so you go to market then for billions of dollars. If you go competitively with one Wall Street firm bidding, you pay a lot to make that deal. You negotiate a deal with multiple firms to get a better deal for Californians. The theory about a loss is what happened in the secondary market subsequent to our deal. Prices change. Yes, they do. That doesn't mean you could make that deal later on. It means you make the best deal you can at the moment you need to go to market, which we did.
Okay. Senator Walters, back to you. Mr. Lockyer has a lot more time than you do, so go ahead. Respond in as much detail as you want.
Well, the treasurer, the reason we also need to have a new treasurer is because...
Well, wait a minute. Talk about this $123 million deal. Did it happen? Are you relying on just one newspaper report? Are you using what he referred to as Tea Party sources?
No, I'm relying on the information that was in several newspapers. And not only that, it was three investment banking firms that they gave the deal to. And even though the taxpayers lost $123 million because the deal didn't go as it should have gone, he also paid those investment banking houses, which he had relationships with, $12 million in fees, when the taxpayers still lost $123 million.
What about his reference to the Mike Milken School of Bonding? Mike Milken, of course, went to jail for junk bond deals. Did you, in fact, work for him? Is that your style of investment?
That's not my style of investments, and no, I did not work for him. I was in a complete different division than Mr. Milken was when I was at Drexel.
Okay. You go on then. You were going to say more about why you think we need a change in the treasurer's office.
Well, the treasurer also sits on the board of the CalPERS and CalSTRS, and which is our retirement plan. And we've lost over $100 billion since 2009 in our pension system. And we also have had many scandals. You talk about the placement agent scandal. There's been the scandal with the City of Bell, where the city officials were ripping off the taxpayers. We've had many failed investments. They're assuming a 7.75% rate of return, which is very questionable, especially in this environment. And as the next treasurer, I will use the resources of the office to open up the process and have more transparency.
How would you do that?
Well, first of all, I would expose exactly what's going on, and I would hold people who are part of CalPERS and CalSTRS and doing the investing. I'd hold them accountable. I'd hold the board accountable. I mean, we have got to have somebody in there that is going to stand up and protect the taxpayer and be a voice for the taxpayer.
Bill Lockyer, back to you. What about the pension systems?
Well, yes, I serve on the PERS and STRS pension boards. The scandals and problems that the senator has been referring to are things that occurred 10 years ago or more recently before I ever got to the board. So it's pretty hard to blame me for something when I wasn't there. Although what I have done is I've led the effort to reform both getting rid of staff, changing the rules, limiting their discretion, sponsoring legislation that doesn't allow people that do business with PERS and STRS to claim a contingency fee payment as a piece of the action for the deal, which, by the way, the senator didn't vote for. But anyhow, I've been a reformer of those systems, and you're right, there are serious problems there. Fortunately, there are, you know, with the business cycle, there are very good and very bad years. This last year, the return has actually been 13.3%, so that's a good year.
Okay. Senator Walters, how would you change the way in which Mr. Lockyer or the Treasurer's Office makes investments? How would you decide where to put the money?
Well, first of all, I would take a look at all the investments that we are currently in. And one thing we have to be careful about is we have had many risky investments. Otherwise, we would not have lost as much money as we had over the years. And how they can actually do an annualized 7.75% return is unconscionable. I mean, what happens is you are misleading the public by saying that we are looking at a 7.75% annual return on an average, and our unfunded, and what that does is it reduces what our unfunded liability really is. I mean, our pension unfunded liability in the state of California could be somewhere up to $500 billion is what some people believe it could be. And we have got to tell the taxpayers the truth and stop playing games with their money. I mean, that kind of rate of return is completely false, in my opinion, because if you look back to when CalPERS actually started, you're going to see that when CalPERS started on an average annual return, it's more like 3.5 to 4%.
Okay, Mr. Lockyer, we've heard 7.3%. We've heard 13%. Are we talking apples and oranges here? What?
No, we're talking about the same number. What kind of investments can you anticipate in a reasonable and prudent investment diversified portfolio of $220 billion? The people that produce these inflated estimates that are just alarmist and, frankly, part of the philosophy to try to privatize the pension system, which I oppose, they're assuming that we're going to invest $200 billion in federal 10-year treasuries, which are currently drawing 2.5% interest. Well, obviously, if you invest that way, all of your money, you're going to have a huge unfunded liability. In fact, if you look not at 2 years or 5 years, some short-term investment horizon, but the long-term historical return, which is how we invest for the long term as patient capital, you find that our returns have been in excess of 8%. Now, that needs to be reviewed, which it is being right now, to see whether the investment assumptions should be ratcheted down. It's done in a very deliberate and thoughtful way with a lot of professionals involved, and I think it probably will get lowered to 7.5, though that's currently being discussed and debated. But the alarmist claims are just inaccurate.
All right, a lot of numbers here. Mr. Lockyer, you refer to greening the state's portfolio in the way that you invest. What do you mean by that?
Well, two things. I should mention, by the way, that I invest, my office, the professionals there, invest $70 billion in short-term investments during this downturn. We didn't lose a nickel. These bad investments that were made, real estate and some other things, were again made years before I got there, and we're cleaning up now after those mistakes that were made. But in addition to that fund, which made $2 billion a year, I bought $300 million in AAA good bonds from the World Bank that are green bonds. They're meant to build alternative energy systems and things of that sort. We get a better return than our normal investment portfolio, and it participates in green. So separate from that, the financing authority that I chair helped bring Tesla Motors into California to have the electric car produced and manufactured here. We do a lot of loans to small businesses for purposes of alternative energy systems and so on. Those kinds of investment practices and loans, as well as the PERS and STIRS emphasis on clean tech, biotech, green technology, I'd like to continue to expand.
Bill Lockyer, the incumbent state treasurer, Democrat, Republican State Senator Mimi Walters, his challenger. Anything wrong with that kind of investment, Ms. Walters?
Absolutely. I mean, he's got a political agenda. You don't invest off of a political agenda. In fact, it's my understanding that my opponent went to the CalPERS board and told them to divest out of two companies that are supporting Prop 23 because he didn't like it. And that's what's absolutely wrong with having a person in that office who has a political agenda and is going to invest in companies that are going to further benefit his political agenda.
These are two companies, Texas companies, that are supporting Prop 23, which would suspend Governor Schwarzenegger's AB 32 until the state unemployment rate was at 5.5% for continuing quarters. Do you support 23, Senator?
I support Prop 23.
You do? Okay. Why?
Because I think that we need to first and foremost, make sure that we have people put back to work. We've got a 12, almost a 12.5% unemployment rate in the state of California. We need less government regulation, and we need to take a look at this AB 32, the regulation that AB 32 is going to be putting on our businesses. You know, we're rated as the 49th out of 50th state, worst state in bringing jobs into the state of California. We've lost 7,000 businesses over the last 3 years. Our number one priority is we need to cut government regulation. We need to put people back to work in the private sector so that we can stimulate this economy. That has got to be our number one priority.
Treasurer Lockyer, what about it? Were you disinvesting because of a political agenda?
No. But it does probably show where we disagree. And I should say these are philosophical points, but probably don't have a lot to do with the day-to-day management of the office. Yes, I do support AB 32 and the effort to address global warming.
You're opposed to Prop 23?
I'm opposed to 23. The Treasurer does make 5 appointments to the stem cell research panel for the state of California. I am pro-choice. I am for embryonic stem cell research. My opponent is on the other side of that debate. So those may matter to somebody philosophically, but the main point is this. We're making investments for California and the long term, our beneficiaries and people that rely on these pension systems. If we can't lead the green revolution to get the advantage of all the new jobs, the new capital, and the new businesses that are going to be growing rapidly, as they currently are, because of the green revolution, we're going to lose our leadership in the planet.
Okay, we've got about 30 seconds left. Senator Walters, your turn. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, we need to have somebody in the office who has knowledge and experience and who's not going to use the office to further their own political agenda when it comes to investing for the taxpayers' money. And I am the person that should be leading us in the Treasurer's office, and I would respectfully ask for the votes of your listeners.
All right. Mamie Walters again, State Senator from Laguna Niguel in Orange County, Republican challenger Bill Lockyer, incumbent State Treasurer, a Democrat. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Warren.
I'll be right back with Which Way LA.
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayLA. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
Warren Olney back with Which Way LA. On Tuesday, Pasadena's Tournament of Roses announced that the Grand Marshal of January's Rose Parade would be Paula Deen, the Southern restaurateur, with 2 shows on the Food Network. She has sold 8 million cookbooks and publishes a magazine with more than 1 million readers, and she built her empire from a home-based meal delivery service. The Tournament of Roses says that makes her the embodiment of this year's theme, building dreams, friendships, and memories. But Pasadena's best-known foodie was not impressed. Paula Deen's recipes include deep-fried Twinkies, and the LA Weekly's Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer Jonathan Gold told the Pasadena Star News the choice was absolutely horrifying. He said Deen exploits and despoils the culinary movement Julia Child did so much to prod into being. Julia Child, another resident of Pasadena. Now, Jonathan Gold has written an open apology. Jonathan Gold, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Why did you have to apologize?
It's not that I didn't write the thing that it's not that the quote was taken out of context, but I wasn't expecting that to be the quote in the story. We were just talking about me possibly being interviewed. And it's easy in a certain respect to look at somebody's media image and make jokes about that without realizing that there's a real person underneath. And I think I probably made a joke at her expense that was maybe not that funny in the long run.
This stuff gets around. I gather that 15 papers in India used that quote.
That's what I found looking through Google this morning.
Well, it doesn't sound like a joke, though, when you say she exploits and despoils the culinary movement that Julia Child did so much to create.
Well, I mean, Julia Child, of course, was probably the person who did more than anybody to create the idea of food through television, to make the idea of really high-quality cooking sort of a right of all Americans. And Paula Deen very much is making people feel good about the food that they already know how to cook.
What's wrong with that?
In a certain way, there isn't anything wrong with that. It's a matter of taste, and she and I are distinctly on different teams. I mean, I would never put a can of cream of mushroom soup in anything, and she seems to put it in half her recipes. She's fond of pushing giant slabs of cream cheese in everything. She uses a lot of, you know, packaged seasoned salt and bouillon granules and, as you said, deep-fried Twinkies. It's not cuisine, but it's entertainment.
Is it unhealthy?
It's probably unhealthy, but I don't think people are cooking the way that she says to cook every day. It's a fantasy. I mean, nobody wants to watch television to watch somebody steam broccoli.
She also said that people in Southern California eat too much tofu and lettuce. Did you find some? Do you want to take issue with that?
I think that's probably what set me off to begin with, that it's a cliche of California cooking that, you know, is the same as Woody Allen talking about sprouts and mashed yeast in Annie Hall in the 70s. And Los Angeles is probably the most diverse restaurant city and eating city in the United States, if not the world, and it shows somebody who doesn't really know the city that well.
Is there a difference between... Is this sort of a high style and low style comparison here?
Well, I don't think it's high style and low style comparison. I mean, I and I think most of my readers do not draw hard and fast comparisons between somebody who happens to make the best soup dumplings in town and somebody, you know, like Wolfgang Puck, who does, you know, haute cuisine just superbly. They're both really good, and they're both really worth eating. And I think that sort of democracy of dining is one of the things that marks our style here.
Well, if she is making people feel good about what they already know, what's undemocratic about that?
It's not. And that's part of the reason I wrote the letter of apology, that the people who watch her, I think, genuinely enjoy watching her. I think they genuinely enjoy the food that she prepares. I think they genuinely enjoy thinking about eating the food that she's preparing on screen, even if they're never actually going to eat that food. And one of the reasons that I felt bad about it is that, although it's something that I am loath to bring up, but it's probably something of a blue-state-red-state divide.
A blue-state-red-state divide that goes to the palate?
Yeah. That here in California or in New York or in Massachusetts, we have a certain platonic idea of what Southern cooking is. You know, the perfect fried chicken and the steaming bowl of lovingly-prepared grits that takes an hour to do, and the shrimp and grits and the gumbo and on and on. And her food takes the theme of Southern cooking and reinterprets it through the medium of convenience food. And it goes against our dream of what that style of food should be. But is it possible that the dream of having, you know, great food, well-sourced, well-produced, well-cooked is elitist? It may be, and there are certainly people who would argue that.
It sounds like you're talking about what people ought to eat, and you think she's talking about what people really eat.
That's possibly so. And in California, I think we actually do eat that way more than they would tend to eat that way in states like South Carolina, as wonderful as some of the restaurants there are.
You're very enthusiastic about the food trucks that have been moving around in Los Angeles. Is that sort of a blue state version of a Twinkie pie?
If the food was bad, it would be. But I think that the trucks going around is really entry-level capitalism at its best, that some of them are obviously just people out for a quick buck, and some of them are just obviously out for the sort of captive office building audience in neighborhoods like, you know, the industrial part of Santa Monica or the Miracle Mile that are fairly poor in, you know, good traditional restaurants. But a certain amount of them, and certainly including Roy Choi, who did the original Kogi trucks, are doing you know, very high quality food with very high quality ingredients, really nicely thought through. And the only difference between the food coming out of the truck and the food coming out of a brick and mortar restaurant is the wheels, frankly, and that it costs a lot less money to get into it to begin with.
Okay, we're out of time. You sent an open letter to Paula Deen. Has she responded?
As far as I know, she hasn't, but I haven't been on my computer all day.
Okay. Jonathan Gold, the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the L.A. Weekly, thanks, as always, for being on our program.
Thanks very much.
You can hear Jonathan every Saturday at 11 o'clock in the morning on KCRW's Good Food. He's also on Good Food on the Road Fridays at 4:44 in the afternoon during All Things Considered. Check out our Which Way LA Facebook page. In a moment, the Tea Partiers and the Congress on Which Way LA. Warman Elney back with Which Way LA. A recent study by the New York Times estimates that about 30 Tea Party candidates have a chance of getting to Congress and 8 or so to the Senate. Kate Zernike reports for The Times, and she's author of a new book called Boiling Mad, Inside Tea Party America. Thanks very much for being on our program.
Thanks, Warren.
How did you determine that 30 or so might get to the Congress and another 8 to the Senate?
We looked. What I did was I went through every race across the country and looked to see where the Tea Party candidates were running, and how many were in districts that we considered either leaning solidly Republican, leaning Republican, or toss-up. So, you know, in other words, they have a good or better than good chance of winning. And so we found 138 candidates in the House and the Senate. And of those, there were 33 House candidates who were in any of those categories. And if you look at the list, I mean, I think a lot of the toss-ups do stand a chance of going Republican this year.
Okay, 33. Let's look at the House. If, in fact, the Republicans take over, not a very large number, but do the Tea Party candidates intend to get together as a separate caucus?
Well, of course, Michelle Bachmann, who's a Tea Party favorite, who's a congresswoman from Minnesota, has already started a Tea Party caucus, and so we could expect some of these people to join it. But I think more importantly, they're sort of an influential voice, whether or not they form an actual caucus. I mean, I think they will sort of put more pressure on the Republican Party to take up issues like increasing privatization of Social Security, of Medicare, of repealing the health care bill that they refer to as Obamacare, and things like that. So I do think that absolutely there will be more pressure on Republicans for spending just because the Tea Party has been so visible and so vocal this year.
What about divisions within the Congress, opposition from other Republicans, or are the other Republicans embracing what the Tea Party is advocating?
You know, it's been really interesting to watch because I think the establishment Republicans have actually been a little bit afraid to say too much about the Tea Party because they desperately want their energy in the elections on Tuesday. That said, there have been some interesting cases. The most interesting to me is Lisa Murkowski, who's, of course, the incumbent senator in Alaska. She was beaten in her primary by a Tea Party candidate, Joe Miller, who now looks – and she decided to run a write-in campaign. And what's happened is she's actually had to come out and say there is a place for big government, especially in a state like Alaska, which gets more money from Washington than it gives. So I think there is, you know, Republicans haven't really wanted to say too much about the Tea Party, but I think there will be, you know, as the Tea Party candidates become Tea Party legislators, a lot of these divisions will flow over into the open.
Once again, there's no party line, no platform for the Tea Party. Is there a philosophy behind them?
Well, you know, I talk about this in my book a little bit because I think the Tea Party did genuinely start there's sort of a libertarian core of the Tea Party. And I think they did, you know, the original people who were planning these protests did have an ideology in mind, which was smaller government, much more restrictive spending. Some of the old things we've heard Republicans, conservatives talk about for years, getting rid of the Department of Education, but being very strict about what we spend money on, not spending money on anything that's not explicitly authorized in the Constitution. But as the Tea Party grew, it kind of attracted a more, you know, a wider base or a wider group of people who were maybe more frustrated about the economy or their own economic situation. And I think they did not come to this with so much of an ideology. And they're also, in many cases, they're on Social Security and Medicare, and they like those programs and they don't want to get rid of them. So I think there's a split even within the Tea Party movement.
Okay. Kate Zernike, once again, national correspondent for the New York Times, covering the Tea Party and also writing a book, Boiling Mad, Inside Tea Party America. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thanks.
Let's talk to a couple of people who identify themselves as Tea Partiers. Chris Littleton is head of Ohio Liberty Council. That's a statewide coalition of 58 Tea Party groups. Chris Littleton, good to have you on our program.
Good to be here.
Do you like either the Democrats or the Republicans?
Not particularly. I think Katie actually said something very interesting, and I think that's true, is that many of us are really rooted in libertarian philosophy, and we would argue that a lot of the things that have brought us to this point, which we're concerned about in the country, have everything to do with both parties. It's not a one party did something worse than the other. They kind of both went down the same road. So, yeah, we have concerns with both.
So if, in fact, the numbers that she estimates get to the Congress, what do you expect them to do? And in what ways do you intend, you who, as I understand it, to live very close to John Boehner, who might well be the next Speaker of the Congress, how do you intend to apply what Kate Zernike calls pressure?
Yeah, there's a sort of a fundamental lack of accountability because the electoral process has moved into something that is a lot of national organizations, a lot of special interest money. I wouldn't call political campaigns at the congressional level and higher grassroots efforts any longer. They manufacture grassroots efforts sometimes, but they're really grassroots. So in order for that to change, and this will take, literally it'll take years. I don't know that's even going to happen in this next Congress. But I'd love to see we're working on, you know, a precinct-based network, one person per voting precinct in every part of Ohio. And then, you know, we call them liberty liaisons, but we want an individual that can walk into congressmen's offices in House, in D.C., look them in the eye and say, I'm your designated person. I have a problem with what's happening. I've been watching you. I see this is in committee. This doesn't sort with our principles. They're sort of – I call it attacked by these lobbyists all the time, and they're always with their hand out, and can you help me with this, can you help me with that, and create this special program, we'll need this earmark. No one is ever really advocating for people, average people who just have really common sense value systems. And so I hope that I'll call us just lobbyists of the people. I hope that starts to emerge and then electoral impact becomes possible. And if that's true and they say, hey, wow, we can tip the scale on elections, even by a few percentages, all of a sudden ears perk up and accountability means something because you've moved out of that more traditional power base that doesn't focus on grassroots, and it starts coming back to individuals from their homes that can make a difference.
Do you want to get rid of Obamacare, of Medi-Cal, and Medicare, rather, and Social Security?
Obamacare, yes. Medicare and Social Security need to be significantly reformed.
Okay.
I mean, they're you know, one and two on federal budget line items, and they absolutely need to be reformed, or else we're just sort of kicking the can down the road and not being really serious about what needs to happen.
Chris Littleton, head of Ohio Liberty Council, statewide organization of 58 Tea Party groups. Mark Hare is an organizer with Mid-South Tea Party in Memphis, Tennessee. And Mark Hare, good to have you on our program.
Hey, Warren. Thanks for having me on.
Of course. Let me ask you a question came out of what we heard from Kate Zernike. You, as I understand it, are a retired Air Force person. You get money from the VA when you need it. Is there a contradiction here between your own situation and the desire to cut the government?
Well, I think there's a difference between doing something for your country and your country rewarding you versus not doing something for your country and your country still giving you something. And really what we're advocating for, Warren, in the Tea Party here in Mid-South in Memphis is fairly simple. We're asking for a balanced federal government that's limited in its size, scope, and power. It's fiscally responsible in its decision-making, not eliminating taxation, but limiting their ability to tax and spend your and my money, and then being responsible at preserving and protecting individual liberties and free markets, and especially governing with the consent of the governed.
Do you think that the country should look more the way it did around 1900?
Well, I was born in 1970, so I'm not really sure, other than what the history books have told me, and I did have a partial public education. I'm not entirely sure if those history books are entirely accurate. Doing my own personal research, there are a few amendments that came out in the beginning of the 1900s that we have some concerns with in the Mid-South Tea Party. I think the 16th Amendment could be revisited, maybe reformed.
What's wrong with that? What does it say? Remind our listeners, and how would you change it?
Well, the 16th Amendment basically reversed the Article 1 of the Constitution, which the Congress directly taxed the states, and then the 16th Amendment took away the direct tax and goes, the indirect tax and goes directly to the individual. Now we have an IRS with 75,000 pages of regulations. It just seems like it would be worth it, regarding our values, to revisit those regulations and see if there's any way that we can reform some of those things, make it a little less complicated, take some of the burden off the American people.
What about the Constitution itself?
Can you be more specific?
Well, sure. It's my understanding that you and other Tea Partiers, not all, obviously there's a broad range of opinion here, really want to go back to, and as you're suggesting, the Constitution as it was originally written, rather than as it has been amended and as it has been reformed, or I should say altered, I guess, in some respects, by the courts.
Well, there's 27 amendments, and those amendments are part of the Constitution. So
right.
Whether I like the 16th Amendment or not, I still have to respect it as the law of the land. It's our foundation. I think the Constitution, from the perspective of the Mid-South Tea Party, is this. It is a foundational document that governs the relationship between the people in the United States. The government is an agent of the people, not the leader of the people. We made the U.S. federal government our proxy. Their job is to secure life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The Constitution is the foundational document to guarantee that function of the government. So our opinion is the government, in some way, shape, or form, has usurped powers that we feel are a bit excessive and possibly not enumerated in the Constitution.
Okay, well, I want to thank you, Mark Herr, organizer with Mid-South Tea Party in Memphis, Tennessee, and Chris Littleton, the head of the Ohio Liberty Council, statewide coalition of 58 Tea Party groups. So thanks for telling our listeners what it is that you guys want to see happens. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you so much, Warren.
I want to introduce now Jill Lepore, who's a professor of American history at Harvard, staff writer at The New Yorker magazine. Her latest book is The Whites of Their Eyes. Jill Lepore, good to have you on our program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
What's your book about?
My book's really a sort of look at how the American Revolution has been claimed by pretty much every political movement or political candidate in American history. Really just kind of set the Tea Party's passion for the story of the Revolution and the embrace of the Constitution in context, and remember that this has been an American political tradition from the very beginning.
Did you hear a bit of evidence for your theory when we were talking with Chris Littleton or Mark Herr? We didn't have very long with them, and Mark Herr was the only one to talk about the Constitution.
Yeah, no, it was good to talk to them. I've been really interested to see how the movement has, the Tea Party is really quite a dynamic movement. You suggested that it embraces a real diversity of opinions, and that's certainly true. But just think about how much it's changed since it began in February of 2009, where really it was inciting the enthusiasm for the Tea Party symbol itself. You know, the time for revolution has come again. Let's dress up like the founding fathers. Let's dump tea. Let's sort of engage in all this political theater that was about the rhetoric of revolution. And then it moved later on into much more of an emphasis on the Constitution, which, is just a less is sort of the stabilizing influence in the founding of the United States. The revolution is, of course, unruly, and the Constitution kind of contained that unruliness. And so the Tea Party kind of moved into much more rhetoric focused around the Constitution, and you heard some of that, of course, from Mark. But now it's really entering a third stage, which I think you heard more from Chris, which is sort of, okay, everybody knows what we're against, but we begin to need to start talking about what we might be for. And I think that's really just beginning, this kind of question of governance.
When you say that everybody has used the American Revolution for one purpose or another, what about the Tea Parties, and what is their view of American history as you see it? And what kind of narrative have they decided to ally themselves with?
Well, you'll hear a lot of different things, and I think for a lot of people in the Tea Party, the revolution is just the name. I don't think that not everybody is passionate about the historical piece, although the strict constitutionalists are, I think, quite literal in their interpretation of the history. But for people in the Tea Party, will say a lot of things about, well, the revolution was about free markets, or the revolution in the Constitution established the United States as a Christian nation. These are kind of themes that you'll hear again and again and again. What's sort of left, there are a lot of things left out of this version of early American history, and it's considerably at variance with what scholars write about in history books. But, left out is the kind of decades of political debate, the philosophy of the Enlightenment, the sort of sparkling and wonderful sort of efflorescence of political ideas that had to be hotly contested over decades of political conversation. There's what's left out are loyalists, like the one-third of the American colonial population that opposed independence. What's left out is the story of slavery and the tortured compromise at the Constitutional Convention that resulted in the Three-Fifths Clause. What's left out is the long evangelical Christian tradition in the United States of dissent over the Constitution because of that. The abolitionist movement's critique of the Constitution, you know, think about William Lloyd Garrison in 1854 burning the Constitution and calling it a covenant with hell while his audience of evangelical Christians cried out amen. I mean, there are many different ways that Americans over the centuries have thought about the Revolution, and the Tea Party's is the most recent, and it's its own, you know, particular version take on the 18th century.
Professor Jill Lepore, again at Harvard, staff writer with The New Yorker magazine, latest book, The Whites of Their Eyes. Larry Sabato is director of the University of Virginia Center for Politics. He's author of a forthcoming book, Pendulum Swing, about the midterm elections. Professor, always good to have you on our program.
Thank you so much.
What about the prospects for the candidates that the New York Times, for example, identifies as Tea Partiers? 33 may make the House, they think. 8 may make the Senate, and who knows beyond that. What kind of influence do you think they might have if they form a caucus, if they ally themselves, or if they challenge the current Republican leadership?
Yeah, I think you used an important phrase there. If they actually get together and form that caucus, they could also end up fighting among themselves, which sometimes happens with revolutionaries. But look, I think the basic problem is they view, at least the many of the Tea Party people who are likely to be elected to the Senate in particular, view compromise as a dirty word. It's the essence of any legislature. A legislature can't function without compromise. I've told many people, if you happen to know and like John Boehner or Mitch McConnell and you want to give them an early holiday gift, send them a case of extra strength Excedrin.
Maybe they can't get together. Maybe they can. And if they do, or even if they don't, one of the things certainly that they agree on, apparently, is that we should get rid of Obamacare, as they call it, the health care reform. And we heard earlier from one of our guests from the Ohio Liberty Council, at least drastically lower the funding for Medi-Cal and Social Security, even if we can't get rid of them. What are the prospects for them to move the Republicans in the Congress in that direction? Will they have the kind of power to do that?
Well, they're certainly going to move the Republican caucus in that direction, but let's assume the Democrats still narrowly control the Senate, the Republicans have a comfortable majority in the House, and of course the Democrats are in charge of the White House. You just simply have a formula for not just gridlock, super gridlock. People say, oh, we did fine after the Republicans won in 94, and they worked together with Bill Clinton, and they came up with deficit reduction and crime and welfare programs. And what these people forget is that at that particular time, you had a large, moderate wing in the Republican Party from the Northeast, the industrial central states, and the West Coast Pacific states. You also had a large number of moderate conservatives in the Democratic Party from the South and border states and some of the Rocky Mountain states. Look, they're almost all gone. The Blue Dogs are going to be the ones who lose in droves on Tuesday for the Democrats, so the Democratic caucus that's left will be much more liberal. The Republican caucus is being infused with Tea Party people who pride themselves on being unwilling to compromise with some of these mainstream Republicans. So the Republican caucus is moving to the right. Do you remember the old adage about how the U.S. and Britain are separated by a common language? Well, that's the way it's going to be for the two parties in Congress. They're going to be talking past one another. It will be super gridlock.
Larry Sabato, director of the University of Virginia's Center for Politics. Jonathan Alter is a columnist for Newsweek magazine. And, Jonathan, good to have you back on our program as well.
Thanks, Warren.
Have the media in general, have we all, done a good job of covering what it is that what kinds of changes are being demanded here and what the consequences might be?
No, I don't really think that we have. I mean, you have in certain cases on your show, and you can find examples of good reporting. But there's been, volumes more reporting on who is going to win and very few predictions, Larry Sabato's comments notwithstanding, of what happens when certain people win. That should be part of our conversation now before the election. You have large numbers of independent voters out there and some moderate Republican voters who are getting ready to go to the polls and vote for mystery dates. You remember in the 60s there was that toy, mystery date. Are you ready for your mystery date?
Sure.
They don't know what these challengers stand for. They don't know how radical Republican they are. And they don't have any sense of the consequences of voting for them in terms of what they might get, in part because the press hasn't done a good enough job of explaining the stakes in the election.
What do you mean by radical Republicans as opposed to moderate Republicans or conservative Republicans?
I think it's radical if you want to, say, repeal the minimum wage, as Racy does in West Virginia. He's running for the Senate there. I think it's radical if you want to, you know, close the EPA and get rid of the Department of Education, as Sharon Engel does in Nevada. To me, that is, there's nothing conservative about that. It's radical. And I think that's, you know, the kind of definitional discussion that we haven't been having.
How important is it when Larry Sabato says, though, that what we're going to see instead of radical change is gridlock?
Well, I think he's quite right that that's the most likely outcome, and that the 2012 presidential campaign will begin right away. But in the meantime, there are other consequences, particularly at the state level, if you have a lot of state houses and state legislatures going into the hands of the Tea Party folks. They will, you know, draw district lines that will make it very hard to dislodge them until the 2020 census, because this is what happens in the first legislative sessions after the census. So it's very, very consequential who's in office right after a census. And then you also have, in the case of judgeships, let's say there's a vacancy on the Supreme Court. What kind of judge will Obama be able to get through? So it's not just, you know, whether legislation moves. There are a lot of other things that relate to regulation, to appropriation, that could have very serious consequences, even if the veto power prevents harmful legislation from being enacted.
Jonathan Alter, again, columnist for Newsweek magazine. Back to Jill Lepore at Harvard and the New Yorker. If, in fact, the Tea Party people do get elected in some substantial number and they aren't able to accomplish a lot, as Larry Sabato suggests, what are the consequences of their disappointment? What will that mean for the rank-and-file Tea Parties? Where will they have to go?
Well, I think a lot of that depends on the economy. I mean, I think at the heart, a lot of what brings people into the movement, has brought people into the movement, is just discontent, both with the economy and with bipartisan politics and existing gridlock. So the super gridlock that Larry was suggesting, and I agree with Jonathan, seems by far the most likely scenario. You know, I think it could perversely just further fuel the movement, right? I mean, especially because for a lot of people in the Tea Party, you know, this constitutionalism is essentially a variety of religious fundamentalism, where the Constitution is sort of taken to be a kind of scripture that cannot be, one cannot speak against or that amounts to heresy. And that brings a kind of a whole new degree of ideological fervor and immovability into political conversation. But one can imagine a core group of people getting only more rigid when that happens.
Larry Sabato, what are the consequences of that, particularly if, as Jonathan Alter suggested, we see district boundaries drawn in such a way that the Republicans are able to increase their numbers in the next election?
Well, I think Jonathan suggested exactly what's going to happen, which is we're in for 2 years of posturing, which will be resolved or maybe not be resolved by the presidential and congressional elections of 2012. Let's remember that presidents, though, have a natural advantage in these conflicts, as Bill Clinton proved 1995-96, and we haven't mentioned the idea of a government shutdown, which I'd say the odds are maybe, what, 2-to-1, 3-to-1 of at least one of them.
Yeah.
Presidents have advantages there. They don't just have the veto power. They have executive orders and the ability to issue regulations and executive agreements, and they can step onto the international stage. And Obama is going to get something he's lacked for 2 years, which is a devil figure. In fact, he'll have a whole series of them.
Jonathan Alter, back to you. We've heard a lot about ideology and how that might be strengthened if the economy stays where it is and if there's not a significant, even radical change in government. You have written often, and you've talked on this program, about how policies affect individuals, including yourself. Just briefly, if you will, remind our listeners what you told us last time about your own situation relative to health care reform.
Well, you know, I'm a cancer survivor, like thousands, millions of Americans. In my case, I've been in remission for 6 years, so I'm doing extremely well. But I'm not insurable were I to lose my job. And you have large numbers of other Americans who, have pre-existing conditions, or maybe they have a kid who's sick. They lose their job. They lose their insurance. They have to sell their house. That's not an exaggeration. By some estimates, 50% of personal bankruptcies in the United States are connected to health care costs. So, you know, these seemingly abstract questions of policy, which, again, have not been well illuminated by the media, which, you know, our business, Warren, has not done enough to convey what's in the health care bill, for instance. These kinds of seemingly arid political conversations have real life consequences for people. So something like the donut hole, which led a lot of seniors to have to pay a lot more for prescription drugs, that's now been closed by the health care bill. And we'll see how seniors react to a series of political arguments that say that health care should be repealed, and as a result, they would be paying more money for their drugs.
That was Jonathan Alter from Newsweek magazine. That's all the time we have. Jonathan Alter, thanks to you, and thanks to the rest of our guests as well for this rebroadcast of today's To the Point. The producers of Which Way LA are Sonia Geis, Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Andrea Brody, Katie Cooper, and Gary Scott. Our managing producer, Karen Radziner. Technical director, Mike Newport. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. Email us. Share your thoughts on our comment page at kcrw.com/whichwayla. Check us out on Facebook. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.